When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
Did you know you can save up to 70% on the best brands just by shopping at FromRebel.com? We're talking about strollers, car seats, high chairs, espresso machines, cookware, everything you need for way less. Here's how it works. Every single day, Rebel drops thousands of new products on the site for up to 70% off. It is a constant stream of endless deals from top brands like Upa Baby, Nuna, Baby Bjorn, Breville, Nespresso, KitchenAid, Le Creuset, and more. But you have to act fast because every deal is one of a kind. So if you see something you love, make sure you add to cart fast. So stop paying full price when you don't have to. Whether it's baby gear, kitchen upgrades, or a treasure for your home you didn't know you needed, Rebel has it for way less, up to 70% less. Shop from Rebel.com and save big.
When 1,000 economists wrote a letter to Trump's all signs saying this is going to be an economic disaster, they did that then to Hoover. And they said, please, please don't do this. But he felt that he needed to do it politically.
Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
Good night and good luck.
Hey, folks, welcome back to the Lincoln Project Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Rick Wilson. I'm delighted to be joined by Andrew Ross Sorkin today. You know Andrew Ross Sorkin from Dealbook. You know him from MSNBC. You know him from CNBC. You know him as the author of Too Big to Fail. And now he has a tremendous and terrifying new book called 1929, Inside the Greatest Crash in History and How It Shattered a Nation. So, Andrew, I want to jump right into this because I've been reading this book and it is, I'm hearing all those, I'm seeing some of those same whispers we hear today of this time it's different. The market's too strong to fall. Nothing could go wrong. What could possibly change the direction up, up, and up? And that was not the case then. And I want to talk about the history first, and later in the conversation, tie it in a little bit more to what's happening now. So tell us about this book and tell us about the shattering impact the 1929 crash had on America, not only economically and financially, but psychologically.
And I would even argue politically. Look, it's interesting because when I first started this project, I actually wasn't looking for parallels. All I wanted to do was write a tale. I wanted to bring the reader inside the room for the first time so they could actually see who the characters were and what they were saying and what their motivations were. And I thought if we could actually see that story, we could understand a lot more about what had happened during that period. The truth was, I didn't know an enormous amount about 1929. I think most of us sort of have a vague notion that something bad happened in 1929. And I always loved books that, you know, read like dramas, Barbarians at the Gate or Den of Thieves, mm-hmm. or so many of these sort of fabulous sort of insider books, by the way, some of the Bob Woodward books. And I thought, has anybody done that to 1929? So mm-hmm. that's really what this was about. But in terms of going back in history and really thinking about that moment and that period, which oddly, as I said, it wasn't intentional, I think more and more seems to mirror this period. I think there was a generational change happening in the 1920s where people thought that you know, we were on a rocket ship. It was the first time that anyone was taking on credit. So we have credit cards today. We take that for granted. That was like a moral sin to take on credit prior to 1919. That was General Motors effectively invented credit in that regard, in that people needed to buy cars and they said, we'll lend you money to go buy a car. And then Sears Roebuck said, hey, we'll do the same for appliances. And then a guy named Charlie Mitchell, who ran a little bank called National City, which becomes Citigroup, decided he too could do this on Wall Street. And you could walk into a brokerage and you could put down a dollar and they would lend you $10 to buy stock. And at that time, there were brokerages popping up around the country on the corners of streets the way there are Starbucks today. And you would literally, it was like a national pastime. You would walk in and the stock market kept going up and up and up. I mean, 1928, people think about 1929, 1928, the stock market had gone up 48%. And so if you were doing this, it was like free money.
And it wasn't just the flush of credit suddenly into the market that caused this. It was also that, you know, that period we're 10 years out of the worst devastation in World War One. The industrialization of America is racing along. Technology is entering the picture. You know, telegraph and radio and telephone have entered into, you know, reshaping the technological landscape. And I guess there was like a sense of optimism there that just could not be shaken by any appraisal of risk. There'd never been in the lifetimes of most of those folks anything like this sort of an uplift. And so they didn't anticipate anything like the scope of the crash, right?
That, and I think they also thought, to the extent that they were aware of panics, 1907 was one.
Sure.
That, you know, we had created the Federal Reserve in 1913, mm-hmm. which was supposed to prevent right. these things from happening. So there were lots of sort of component parts to that moment. And, you know, you talked about telephone and also about, you know, radio. You know, we talk about AI today. I was going to say, like, back then, NVIDIA was like the meme stock. I'm sorry, RCA was like the meme stock of the era. RCA mm-hmm. would have been like NVIDIA today.
Yeah.
And so people thought
that's a great analogy.
It was just a real shift in terms of how people thought, and therefore everybody thought, I have to get in. And it was also a time where the media actually played a huge role in this, because all of a sudden these business leaders are showing up on the cover of magazines the way Babe Ruth and Charles Lindbergh used to. All of a sudden Wall Street CEOs are now there, the same way I think we would look in, you know, look at an Elon Musk or, you know, Steve Jobs or all of these other guys who've been lionized.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody wanted in.
It did seem to be the sort of defining characteristic of that of you know the media aspect of the finance world suddenly got very front and center. There were people that were seen as financier types, Wall Street types. I think for the first time that weren't connected to like industrial growth. There were always like, you know, barons of industry types that were in the media, but this was a period where suddenly it was the guys who were manipulating money on Wall Street who were getting famous as well.
I mean, Bernard Baruch was a name.
Mm-hmm.
There was a guy named John Raskob who I would argue is almost like Elon Musk today, who was,
right.
you know, he was involved. He'd ran General Motors at one point. He became close to he was on his way to being a billionaire. There were two billionaires in 1929, actual billionaires, not inflation adjusted. They were like real billionaires. Rockefeller and Ford became the second billionaire mm-hmm. ever. But John Raskob was, you know, this was one of these guys. The press would eat up anything he said. They would rush over to his office to talk to him. It was literally like an Elon Musk kind of situation. And then, by the way, he doesn't own the equivalent of Twitter, but he actually gets involved in politics. Ends up going after Hoover in all sorts of crazy ways, and then builds the equivalent of what would have been a rocket ship back then. He was responsible for creating the Empire State Building in that year. And he mm-hmm. also happens to have 13 children, which is not that far off from Elon.
Right. Elon may have exceeded that number by now. There's always another one popping up somewhere. You know, as the weather cools off, I'm swapping in my wardrobe pieces that actually get the job done. Stuff that's warm and durable and built to last. You know, Quince delivers every time, with wardrobe staples that'll carry you through the season. Quince has all kinds of fall staples that you'll want to wear on repeat, like 100% Mongolian cashmere from just $60. I'm actually wearing them right now. I love these sweaters. They are fabulous quality. Then they've also got classic fit denim, leather, and wool outerwear, and all that looks sharp, and it holds up. You know, I've got my eye on the suede trucker jacket. I think it's a little bit of a fashion departure for me, but it looks like you could layer it, and it's a really good put-together look from it. You know, by partnering directly with ethical factories and top artisans, Quince cuts out the middleman and provides stuff at a price point that is remarkable for the quality you're receiving. Half the cost of many other brands. It's why Renee and I love Quince. You know, she recently picked up, before our trip to London, a piece of Quince luggage, which I didn't even know existed until then. A quilted duffel that she took to London, and we're hard travelers, and it held up great. Quince has really become kind of a go-to for us across the board. I don't know if you've picked up anything else, but they've got all these new categories I didn't even know about. You know, bedding, cookware, luggage, travel accessories, furniture. It all follows the same Quince standard. And that same Quince standard is to, again, to partner with really great creative artisans, people who take pride in what they're building and providing to you, and who do it at a price that is amazing, considering the unbelievably high quality you're receiving. So look, layer up this fall with pieces that feel as good as they look. Go to quince.com/Lincoln for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada also. That's quince.com/Lincoln for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/Lincoln. We love Quince. We think you will too. As we're in this absolute bubble of uncanny optimism, what were the early signs? What were the cracks that were appearing out there? But what were the things that people didn't spot that should have warned them at the time of a coming crash?
Well, look, there were. I don't want to say that they couldn't spot them, because the truth is, and this is again weirdly parallel to now, there was a massive debate going on inside the Federal Reserve in the spring of 1929 about whether they should lower or raise interest rates to try to snuff this whole situation out. And they were so worried, actually, at the time, a little bit about their own independence and the political pressures at the time, about what they could or could not do about it. And you had all sorts of different competing players, you know, chiming in. Charlie Mitchell, the banker at National City, was almost like Donald Trump. He was saying, no, we need lower interest rates. Lower the interest rates, please.
What we really want to do, and I think I can speak for Tim, and I think I can speak for the entire Senate, we can speak for everybody, frankly, is we want to see interest rates come down. Our country is booming, and the interest rates is a final little notch. And if you look at Europe, they've lowered 11 times in a short period of time. We've lowered zero. And, they are competition, although we're in the process of probably making a very good deal with them, too. They want to make a deal very badly, very badly. So we're making a deal. We just completed our deal with Indonesia. We just completed our deal with the Philippines. We're making unbelievable deals. And the money is pouring in. We want to get interest rates down.
But on interest rates, at some point, does the level of interest rates now slow economic growth?
Yeah, it never helps it if it's high. Never helps it. Well, it's already as good as we're doing. Think of how well we'd be doing. We'd be like a rocket ship. As good as we're doing, we'd do better if we had lower interest rates. And we should. We're prime. Don't forget, without us, the whole world collapses. So we should have the lowest interest rate, because, you know, you can talk about Switzerland, you can talk about wonderful countries, no debt, no. But without us, everything collapses. We should have the lowest interest rate. And if you took it down 3 points, not a little bit, but 3 points, if you got us down to one, we would save more than $1 trillion, basically, with just a paper transfer. You wouldn't be cutting costs of anything. You wouldn't be building anything. Just a move of the hand saying, we're going to lower interest rates. You would save $1 trillion a year. And there's nothing you can do to save that kind of money.
And then there were other people on the board saying, well, we should raise them. And then there were other people saying, well, if we raise them, we're going to get hauled in front of Congress and they're going to kill us. So I think people saw that things were getting heady. They just couldn't conceive that there was a problem on the other end.
So there were signs. There were omens out there on the horizon. There was lightning on the horizon at night. And there were a number of factors that contributed to this. Tariffs are famously part of the narrative of this. Talk to us about how the tariff situation and Smoot-Hawley was affecting the mental state of the market at that point.
Well, so back when Hoover was trying to get himself elected, one of his campaign promises to the farmers, to the agriculture industry, was he was going to implement tariffs. Mm-hmm. And by the way, the economists hated this idea. Anybody in a big city hated this idea, but
sure.
But the farmers, they love this idea. Mm-hmm. So Hoover gets inaugurated March 4th. The date is different, by the way, back then than it was now.
Yep, yep.
And he decides he needs to keep his promise. Having said that, literally exactly like now, when 1,000 economists wrote a letter to Trump's all signs saying this is going to be an economic disaster, they did that then to Hoover. And they said, please, please don't do this. But he felt that he needed to do it politically. And he puts the tariffs in place. And literally within 12 months of putting those tariffs in place, global trade falls by something like 60%, literally 60%. And so the tariff piece, which happened in 1930, was just the next domino. You know, I often think of 1929 and this book really as not just about 1929. It's about a period almost from 1929.
And how the Depression flows from.
And how the Great Depression flowed from this sort of horrific moment in October of 1929, but that was almost the lead domino that then led to a whole series of bad decisions. And some of those were political decisions. You had people like Andrew Mellon, who was the Treasury Secretary back then, screaming, you know what? Let him eat it. Let him suffer. He was a true capitalist in his mind. His view was, we don't help people. There's no helping. Nobody's coming to save the day. And so all of the things we did, by the way, in like 2008 to bail out banks or to flood the system with money. ZERP.
Yeah.
We know everyone hates bailouts. It's one thing both sides agree on. So the question is, why is there a so-called $50 billion bailout fund in the bill, and why is everyone arguing about it? Okay, first, the fund is not taxpayer money. It's banks' money. And according to the bill, banks would pay into this pot of money, would just sit there waiting while these banks are functioning healthy. It would wait until one of these firms starts to go bad. Now, eventually, if that firm gets so sick that the government is convinced that its toxins could spread and infect the whole economy, government officials will come in and break it up. But just like a real funeral, that costs money. There are expenses associated with smoothly closing a business. So where would that money come from? Under this bill, it would come from that $50 billion pot of money that the banks have been paying into. So in essence, these banks would pay for their own funerals, Suzanne.
Okay, so Jessica, it sounds like the fund could be taken out of the bill as part of a negotiation. Some folks are calling for that. Where would this money come from?
That's right. And as you point out, even the administration doesn't want this fund. So if it's negotiated out, couple options. After one bank fails, the other surviving banks could be required to pay the funeral costs, at least. Or the other option is that taxpayer money could be used, at least temporarily. If this bailout fund doesn't exist, taxpayers could temporarily pay for the funeral costs and it would be paid back. And that's the irony. If you get rid of the fund, it actually increases the chance that taxpayer money will be spent.
That was not, none of that happened. And in fact, one of the reasons it did happen in 2008 was because Ben Bernanke, who was the head of the Fed then, actually did his thesis at Princeton.
Wasn't that his PhD thesis?
That was his PhD thesis at Princeton on the Great Depression.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/audioboom.
Time. It's always vanishing. The commute, the errands, the work functions, the meetings, selling your car. Unless you sell your car with Carvana. Get a real offer in minutes. Get it picked up from your door. Get paid on the spot. So fast, you'll wonder what the catch is. There isn't one. We just respect you and your time. Oh. You're still here? Move along now. Enjoy your day. Sell your car today.
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
So we end up, we're in this moment. Tell us about the last day before the crash. Tell us about that last day before the crash and the day of the crash and how shattering it was for the country.
Well, the truth is that there were probably 3 or 4 days of the crash, oddly enough. It really sort of started on Thursday. There seemed to be a terrible downdraft on a Thursday. Over the weekend, they thought maybe things were going to get better. Monday opened up, it was worse. And Tuesday, it was even worse. And we were talking about, you know, the stock market collectively falling during that period, and within the month, something like 40, 50%. Having said that, when you go back and look at the end of the year of 1929, oddly enough, the year ended. Stock market was off, I think, in total about 17%. But here was the thing. So many people had bet money with leverage, meaning they had gotten loans to buy. So when the market fell, it wasn't just that they were losing the money that they had put in. All of a sudden, they owed so much more money. And even Groucho Marx was playing the market, gets a call literally from his broker, says, you got to get down here and pay up, basically. And he ends up having to mortgage his home.
Wow.
To pay the bill.
I mean, the people that are buying that are buying equities on credit. I mean, the scope of it now is so much larger than it was then. It's what sort of rattles me a bit. But on that day, during that drop off, you ended up with people, you know, dead in the streets practically, or literally in some cases. You ended up with these folks who saw no way out. I mean, and this sort of psychological impact has become almost part of like our national folklore about the beginning of the Depression.
Well, I'll tell you a story that actually I don't put in the book because it's a personal story. My grandfather, who's no longer alive, Sidney Sorkin, died when he was 91 years old. He was, I believe, about 11 then. And he and his brother had been messenger boys down there during October of 1929. He used to always tell a story about how he saw somebody jump out the window and kill himself right in front of him. And for the rest of his life, this goes to the generational scarring issue you're talking about, he never bought a share of one stock, ever. He used to buy bonds, he kept cash, and he used to say, Andrew, the stock market is not for us. And I think that's actually, there was an entire generation of people who actually felt that way.
For sure. I mean, that's my grandmother's generation. And you know, that idea of, in her case, it was you buy real property, bonds, or it's in cash. She trusted banks by the 60s, but it took a while. I think that whole silent generation block, you know, that shape, that was the classic granny with the mattress full of cash era. I don't want to lose my money. I mean, so you end up with this shattering event. Talk to us about how the government, how the president started to react to it, and how it shaped the arrival eventually of Roosevelt. I know we're stretching out the time frame a little bit, but talk to us about how the government, and I think you could largely say they failed to truly respond to it in a way that could have mitigated some of it. Talk to us about how the government responded to this.
Well, the problem was that the government, and Hoover in particular, tried to convince the country that this was like a psychological problem, that it wasn't a real problem. And so there were sort of these very bizarre periods. In fact, Hoover famously, I don't know if people know it really, he's the one who came up with this phrase, the Great Depression. He stopped using the word panic. He thought the word panic was actually a bad word to use, and that actually the word depression would be sort of more politically palatable because it was something that, you know, didn't have such an acute nature to it.
Among the misreads of this.
So, you know, that was one mistake. The tariffs were another mistake. At one point, Hoover brought all the CEOs into the Oval Office suggested that they basically start hiring more people. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a lot of jawboning going on.
Sure.
By the way, it may very well be that President Trump is a much better jawboner in terms of getting these CEOs to fall in line than Hoover was at the
sure.
time. Though the truth is, I think the companies were struggling so mightily during that period that you couldn't have pushed them to do just about anything, except for Henry Ford. Henry Ford actually decided he was going to hire more people and raise their hourly wages, in part, I think, to embarrass Hoover and to embarrass all the other CEOs who frankly couldn't afford to do such a thing.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
All right, remember, the machine knows if you're lying. First statement, Carvana will give you a real offer on your car all online.
False.
True, actually. Oh. You can sell your car in minutes.
False? That's gotta be...
True again. Carvana will pick up your car from your door, or you can drop it off at one of their car vending machines.
Sounds too good to be true, so true!
Finally caught on. Nice job. Honesty isn't just their policy, it's their entire model. Sell your car today, too.
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
The other piece of this was legislation, which oddly enough did not come until, frankly, 1933, and really led to Roosevelt to get the job. But, you know, we didn't have an SEC prior to this. You know, people who've read this book, they said to me, well, when you were doing the research, did you ever read a prospectus for one of these stocks? And I said, a prospectus? What are you talking about? They didn't even have, they had like leaflets at best.
Right. Right.
Nobody was telling you. There's no insider trading laws. There's nothing. So the SEC gets created, obviously, in 1934. And in 1933, Carter Glass, who's a huge character in this book, who's
yes,
a fascinating guy. He was a senator in Virginia. He puts together a bill, but how it gets put together is wild, that it breaks up the banks from being the sort of banking operation from the casino operation.
Right. And which we, of course, by the late 80s had reassembled the banks and the casinos.
We had, and in fact, people like Elizabeth Warren and frankly, a lot of the the sort of the left, if you will, post-financial crisis 2008, used to herald Carter Glass as, you know, a genius for having created this fabulous bill.
Shouldn't we just tell the American consumer that no matter what we do, there will be bank boom and bust cycles, no matter what the laws and regulations? You can't protect everything.
No, that is just wrong.
Why?
Look at the history.
Look at history. We're filled with booms and busts from the Dutch tulip crisis to now.
From 1797 to 1933, the American banking system crashed about every 15 years. In 1933, we put good reforms in place for which Glass-Steagall was the centerpiece. And from 1933 to the early 1980s, that's a 50-year period, we didn't have any of that. None. We kept the system steady and secure. And it was only as we started deregulating. You start hitting the S&L crisis. And what did we do? We deregulated some more. And then you hit long-term capital management at the end of the 90s. And what did we do as a country? This country continued to deregulate more. And then we hit the big crash in 2008. You are not going to defend the proposition that regulation can never work.
I didn't say regulation never worked, Senator, by far and away. And I agree, there were fewer bank failures in that time after Glass-Steagall.
Of the big ones, zero.
But Continental Illinois was the seventh biggest bank in the United States when it failed.
It took 50 years to get there.
But, Senator, you're on the record saying Glass-Steagall would not have prevented the financial crisis.
Not all by itself. That's absolutely right. But what Glass-Steagall can do is it can wind some more of the risk out of the system. It can help bring down the size of the largest banking institutions. Don't forget, you said there was too much concentration in the banking industry in 2008. Now here we are in 2013, and the big four are 30% bigger. That puts too much risk back in the system.
I think if they actually, I didn't know it going into this project, if they really understood how this bill got put together, which, by the way, included lobbying and money and bankers trying to screw each other and all sorts of other shenanigans that had almost nothing to do with sort of trying to make
regulatory propriety.
But it's fascinating.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
So I want to jump forward a little bit. You know, the Great Depression drags on and on and on. It shapes that silent generation profoundly. Roosevelt starts to get some traction under him. World War II and the massive industrialization starts to, you know, be said to have ended the Great Depression. Is there a moment that you, other than say Pearl Harbor, that you think that the impact of 1929 on the markets stopped really being this like dark cloud, this huge overhang?
Oh, goodness. I think that it still hangs over the markets. I was just down at the New York Stock Exchange last week, and they still talk about it with sort of the same kind of anxiety and almost reverence. I'm sure that Pearl Harbor, or at least I would imagine Pearl Harbor, outdid the crash in 1929.
I just think about that, like the Like the
look, 9/11, I think.
Sure.
You know, I think they're barring a war, though, I think there's not much.
Right. Right. So let's fast forward a little bit to the era that we live in. We've seen the market have any number of mid-sized crashes, you know, 86, 2000, 2008, the COVID era. Do we have sufficient fire breaks, procedural things to stop another 1929 if the market suddenly goes, you know, sideways?
So if you had asked me this question a couple of years ago, I would have said yes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember back in 2008, Jamie Dimon, who runs JP Morgan, used to tell a story about how his daughter had come home and said, "Daddy, what's a financial crisis?" And he said, "Something that happens every 5 to 7 years." And I think it's true that we have lived with some form of a bubble bursting, you know, every couple of years here and there.
Sure.
I do think something has shifted in the last decade, and specifically probably in the last 3 or 4 years, even more importantly, and even, and especially in this past year itself, which is the guardrails are being taken off. That is the biggest difference. So, you know, literally just in the last couple of weeks, President Trump announced plans for publicly traded companies to no longer provide quarterly earnings disclosures.
Yeah.
He says, you know what? It's too costly to do. The CEOs are not focused on their business long term. We should only do this twice a year. Well, all of a sudden, you're taking transparency away from the market, if that's the case. You know, there have been a number of bills that have passed now that are going to make crypto a huge part of people's pocketbook and bank account. Some of which is going to be highly leveraged, meaning there are people borrowing a ton of money to do this. One of the bills is going to allow people to take private equity and venture capital and private credit and put it in your 401k. And all of that is being promoted as democratizing finance, which very much was the conceit in the 1920s. We need to democratize finance. You know, the elites are getting richer. And the public needs to have access. Same story that we're hearing today.
Right.
And so you said, you know, do I think we have the brakes in place? I think we have a lot of the brakes still in place. I think to the degree you believe the Federal Reserve is independent and can actually pump money into the system if it needed to, yes, I think that's a break. But I do think there are some cracks in the brakes.
Okay. One of those cracks would strike me as Trump's ongoing, very persistent efforts to remove the Fed's independence to some greater or lesser degree. Talk to me about where you see that. I mean, the Fed was a fairly new institution in 1929, and now it is, I think, probably under attack more than it's ever been in my lifetime, I think. Talk to us about what the impact of if the Fed becomes politicized or loses its independence, what do you think is the logical outcome of that?
I think there's a couple of real problems if the Fed loses its independence. And I think, by the way, President Trump has made comments not just about wanting to influence the Fed, but he's talked about for the first time having a majority. He uses the word majority as if it's the Supreme Court or if it's Congress. By the way, in the past, we didn't like to use the phrase majority in the context of the Supreme Court either.
Right.
So there's definitely an effort to influence the Fed.
Jerome Powell, you said that the termination of Jerome Powell cannot come fast enough. He says he won't leave even if you ask him to.
Oh, he'll leave. If I ask him to, he'll be out of there. But I don't think he's doing the job. He's too late, always too late, a little slow. And I'm not happy with him. I let him know it. And if I want him out, he'll be out of there real fast, believe me.
And what does that mean? It potentially means that the decision-making would really be driven by what the White House wants them to do, which is if they want them to lower interest rates, and goose the market at any one moment, they lower interest rates. If they want to tighten things up, they tighten things up. But I think the bigger issue at some point, and the question is when the market would react to this, you would think that the bond market, that investors who effectively lend money to U.S. taxpayers would say, you know what? There's a higher risk premium now to do this because I don't know if I'm actually going to get my money back the way I expected to. And so I'm going to charge a higher interest rate for that. And if that's the case, then you have a bigger problem. I've always thought that the bond market should be the last, I don't know if it should be, it in practicality, it's the last governor over the political class. You know, after an election,
Trump still does respond to the bond market, I think, more than a lot of other cues.
Absolutely. I mean, and the truth is, you know, you go back and look at the tariffs that he announced back in April. And if you remember, he really walked a whole lot of it back, in large part because the bond market got rattled. So I do think there still is that influence. Having said that, you know, there's been a lot of people who've had their hair on fire saying, oh, my goodness, bonds are going to cost so much more. Anytime there's even a question about the independence, the bond market's going to get upset. I also worry that the bond market itself could be too short-term oriented because so many of them are already thinking to themselves, you know what? Come May, Jay Powell, who's the current Fed chairman, is going to be out of the job. His term is up. President Trump is going to install somebody else in his place. That person invariably is going to lower interest rates because that's what the president wants. And from their vantage point, you know, I'm not sure why they haven't, why the bond market has not reacted differently. I understand why the equity market has reacted. By the way, I think the equity market's already looking at that saying, oh, the punch bowl is being put back on the table.
Right. They've ordered more chicken wings. The next thing I wanted to ask you about is, we touched on it a little bit, our current economic situation is, I think a lot of it's being driven by the tariff questions that are, you know, in the ag sector in particular. And, you know, I think the tariff stuff and the immigration stuff are sort of a hand-in-hand double disruption on a lot of the working class sector of this economy right now. Do you see parallels to what to 1929 and any of that in terms of the things that are disrupting the market that we know are there that could have a broader and more significant impact?
So I actually worry that it is similar to 1929 in that you have these underlying fault lines in the economy as it relates to tariffs, immigration, agriculture, but it's being papered over, or most people are not seeing it, because in some ways there's so much focus on this AI boom that's taking place. And by the way, the AI boom is real insofar as there's real cash, hundreds of billions of dollars that's being committed and spent, and that's trickling down throughout the economy. The question is, that's also built on a pile of debt. And so how long the AI economy can either paper over or prop up the rest of the economy, I think, is a real question. And by the way, we haven't even talked about what happens on the other end of the AI boom, which is to say, if you thought that 25% unemployment was bad in, you know, 1932,
wait till AI blows out every CPA, attorney, actuary, HR person, and on and on and on and on in that gray collar and white collar part of the economy. And it doesn't take AGI super intelligence or anything like that. It's just wider deployment of the current state of technology for LLMs. I think
you're already seeing it. I mean,
massive, you know, disruption.
Graduates out of Stanford, you know, the hiring
the CS grads, yeah,
is so much lower than it used to be. You know, you probably read that big article in the New York Times.
I saw it.
Some of them are working at Chipotle. I mean, think about that. Engineers that would have been coders are working at Chipotle. If that's true, where is this all headed?
Yeah, I mean, the decapitation of a sector of the economy that was very post-industrial by even today's LLM level AIs, I think is still an undercounted risk across everything, across all the markets.
But it's so interesting. The markets almost discount it because it's almost too hard to model. Just don't know what it will be.
Right. And scary thing on horizon is scary, but they haven't gone through. I mean, if the ripple effect on everything, if it starts to blow out white collar jobs, is.
So I have a question for you, Rick, which is politically, why has that not become a real issue yet?
I think because so much chaos has surrounded Trump, it's hard. I've talked to a few Democrats about this. I've talked to a few Republicans about this too. Like the person or party who gets ahead of this and says, okay, AI is going to change everything. We can't necessarily stop that, but we can start to try to mitigate the impact on people. And look, as a conservative, I wonder how we respond to it. Is it some UBI version? Is it some tax on the AI rev stream that goes back to American work? I don't know the answer, but I know the political impact of this is going to be tidal. It's going to be on the scale of the political impact of it will be beyond anything we can consider. And ironically, at the lowest end of the economy, it's not going to immediately replace pipe fitters and plumbers and roofers, but it's going to replace and some of the touch aspects, not going to replace doctors and dentists right away, but there's a huge block of folks in that soft information economy that are just going to be, it's over, including attorneys. I know some folks in practice at white shoe law firms who are now planning, they're going to slow down their hiring for associates because they don't need them now in the way they once did. They're now looking for people that are going to go out and be able to generate business, not just you know, do the grunt work. AI is going to take over a lot of that. It's going to change the world.
I just used an LLM. Someone had sent me a contract, 10-page contract to look over.
Yep.
I noticed three things I didn't love in it. Mm-hmm. I put it into ChatGPT. I said, tell me everything that's good and bad for me in this agreement.
Great.
It's not only spotted the three things I caught, it spotted three others. It then said, would you like me to create a red line version of this contract for you? I said, sure, it did.
Yep.
It said, would you like a cover letter to return it back? It wrote a beautiful letter back in language that I probably wouldn't have used. The language is even better than I would have used, way better. And 45 minutes later, contract was done. And guess what? There was no lawyer used.
Yeah, I'm telling you, this is the political implications of it are underscored by miles. We are not ready at all. I'm constantly amazed by people who have now got $250,000 or more of debt for a CS degree, who were about to be, Chipotle workers for the foreseeable future. So, well, Andrew, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today. Folks, the book is 1929, Inside the Greatest Crash in History and How It Shattered a Nation. I'm about 2/3 of the way through it, Andrew. It is fascinating. And it's dark, but it is a great tale of human nature that people from today will recognize, like the ambition and cupidity and venality and fear and response. All of it is wrapped up in this. It's a tremendous read. I look forward to seeing you again soon, Andrew. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Rick, this was a ball. Thank you so much. I appreciate
it. You bet.
The Lincoln Project Podcast is a Lincoln Project production. Executive produced by Whitney Hayes, Ben Howe, and Joey Wartner-Cheney. Edited by Riley Main. Hey, folks, if you want to support the Lincoln Project's work against Donald Trump, Elon Musk, and this MAGA craziness, go to action.lincolnproject.us/helplp. If you'd like to get in touch or have suggestions for a guest or a show topic, or just want to say hi, our email is podcast@lincolnproject.us. For our MAGA friends, please, no more nudes. Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Good night, and good luck.